This event is presented by the Council on Foreign Relations.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations State and Local Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach. Thank you for being with us today. As you may know, the CFR State and Local Officials Initiative Series is serving as an authoritative, politically independent resource and forum for bipartisan discussion on pressing international issues that affect the priorities and agendas of state and local governments. Today's conversation, opening remarks with Jamila Biggio will be on the record, and then our question and answer session that will follow will be not for attribution, so we can have a more candid discussion. We're delighted to have Jamila Biggio with us today to talk about gender parity in the workforce. She is a senior fellow in the Women and Foreign Policy Program here at CFR. She previously served as Director for Human Rights and Gender on the White House National Security Council staff. She also served as a senior advisor to U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues, Melanie Verveer, within the Office of the Secretary of State. She led the interagency launch of the U.S. National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security, an effort for which she was recognized with the U.S. Department of State Superior Honor Award and the U.S. Department of Defense Secretary of Defense Honor Award. So with that, I would like to thank you, Jamila, for being with us today. It was really terrific to have you and people from around the country joining the call. CFR's Women in Foreign Policy Program recently released an interactive report on workforce equality around the world, which you all can access on our website, cfr.org. Jamila, I thought it would be great if you could start by talking about the economic benefits of gender parity in the workforce.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Irina, and thank you all for joining us today. Thrilled to have the opportunity to talk to you all about gender parity in the workforce in the United States. So as Irina mentioned, the Council on Foreign Relations Women and Foreign Policy Program looks at the status of women and girls around the world, including in the United States, and how elevating that status will advance growth and prosperity. And that's something that we know that no country and no state or city can get ahead by leaving 50% of its population behind. So where we look at the economic benefits of women's workforce participation, here we've seen a growing and strong body of evidence demonstrating that women's economic participation improves prosperity, not only for women, but for everyone. Major financial institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have shown that women's participation in the economy reduces poverty and grows GDP. As Irina mentioned, our program recently launched two new reports. One is entitled Growing Economies Through Gender Parity. And there, we can circulate the link afterwards, but this visualizes the relationship between women's economic participation and GDP growth. And it shows that by closing the gender gap in the workforce, could add a staggering $28 trillion to global GDP. And this is not only in developing countries that would benefit the United States, the U.S. economy would grow by $4.3 trillion or 19% by 2025 if we close the gender gap between men and women at work. And this comes out to more than $13,000 per person increase in per capita incomes. The McKinsey Global Institute has this data broken down by state as well. So you can see what the estimates are for your state of what the economic gains would be if women participated in greater numbers in the workforce. One thing they documented is that all states can increase their GDP by at least 5% in a best-in-class scenario where you're just improving, not to even full parity, but you're just improving rates of women's participation in the labor force, increasing the hours that they work, increasing the roles and levels that they serve at. But there are significant barriers that are preventing women from participating despite the benefits. And these we see as breaking down along structural, legal, and cultural obstacles that keep women out of the workforce. And this is everything from the significant load of unpaid care work that predominantly women hold. So time that is spent on unpaid care work is time not spent on paid work that would generate income and contribute to reducing poverty and growth in states. We see challenges in the U.S. for single mothers, for teenage pregnancy, also issues around political participation that affects the kinds of legislation and policies that cities, states, and countries pursue, and how these respond to addressing the structural and cultural barriers preventing women from engaging in the workforce. We also see gaps in leadership and managerial positions in the United States, where women are significantly underrepresented still in leadership roles. And this not only affects the bottom lines for companies, been documented that companies with greater diversity in management roles on their boards have higher returns. But that lack of diversity also affects the policies that and the effectiveness of state governments, of institutions, of organizations pursuing their mandates. In the United States, looking at what workforce participation, what the data is, in 2000, women's labor force participation rate was 77.3%, and it's actually dropped since then. So as of September 2017, it was 75.2% compared to 88.6% for men. So we see some quite sobering statistics when we look at what's happening with rates of women's labor force participation in the United States. Working married women bring home 44% of their family's income, and this relates to some issues around equal pay, women being more likely to work part-time. We also see to that point that women perform 64% of part-time jobs in the United States and only 42% of full-time jobs. We'll talk about some of the specific barriers that are keeping women out of the workforce and thereby removing a partner and an actor that would help states again reduce poverty and advance economic growth in their states. There's been a lot of thinking and some really innovative work done at state level to try to address some of these structural and cultural and legal barriers. So to strengthen employee retention, some of the top policy priorities that states are pursuing include paid leave, workplace flexibility, childcare, providing quality, affordable preschool and childcare options, combating workplace discrimination, and creating career pathways and low-wage jobs to expose women in these roles to managerial and leadership opportunities that can lead to higher wages and more advancement opportunities. We've also seen increased attention to pathways to quality employment for women, and that includes looking at equal pay, addressing minimum wage rates. We've know that women make up nearly two-thirds of minimum wage workers, so raising the minimum wage, in fact, would help shrink the gender wage gap. So those are kind of some of the key buckets. So let me now dig in more specifically on a few of these and talk about the benefits and some of the examples of what we've seen states do. So first, looking at paid family leave. So just to note here on some of the benefits, one study in the U.S. found that women who utilize paid family leave are nearly 40% less likely to receive public assistance or food stamps in the year following a child's birth compared to women who take no leave. Providing family leave increases companies' retention rates. So Google, in fact, found that when they increased paid maternity leave in 2007 from 12 to 18 weeks, that it achieved a 50% reduction in the rate at which new mothers left the company. California was the first state to institute paid leave, in fact, in 2002. And a review found that 90% of companies in California reported that the policy either had a neutral effect on them or had, in fact, boosted profits. But despite the benefits, the United States is, in fact, the only advanced economy that does not, at the federal level, guarantee some form of access to paid maternity, parental, family, or sick leave to its workforce. And so this is an area where, in the absence of that, states have been leaders in trying to fill that gap. Four states, California, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island, currently have paid family leave insurance programs being implemented. New York's is the most generous at 12 weeks when it is fully implemented in 2021. Three additional states have adopted a legislation that that will be moving into implementation, and that includes D.C., Washington State, and Massachusetts. We've also seen, in the absence of policy covering the entire state, we've seen action by state governments on their own. For example, in Missouri, in March, the governor signed an executive order granting paid parental leave to employees in the governor's office or in agencies controlled by his appointees. And what followed from there is for other statewide elected officials and the House of Representatives issued similar executive orders. And so at this point in Missouri, nearly all employees of state agencies are able to take paid time off following birth or adoption of a child. So you see a range of policies both at state level and in the absence of, as I said, kind of a full legislation, you see some innovation being done through executive order. Subsidized child care. So child care in the United States is another key area. The lack of quality, affordable preschool or child care options has significant economic implications for families. Without these options, both men and women have limited ability to find and keep jobs. A study by the Department of Health and Human Services, in fact, found that higher child care subsidy expenditures significantly increased labor force participation and employment rates of low-income mothers in the United States. And likewise, research has shown that women are considerably less likely to leave the labor force when child care facilities are more readily available. A 2015 survey by the Washington Post, though, found that more than 75% of mothers report having passed up work opportunities, switched jobs, or quit their jobs in order to tend for their children where they did not, in some cases, because they opted to do that, you know, out of choice, and in some cases, because they did not have access to affordable child care. And here, the Economic Policy Institute found that child care costs are one of the most significant expenses in a family's budget. In 33 states, infant care is more expensive than college. So again, looking at what can the United States do, here there's some policy recommendations that have looked to supplement some of the existing programs. So there is already a federal program that's targeting low-income families in each state, and that provides a mechanism to provide subsidies. But right now, it is significantly underfunded. So it certainly It's a tool that's not yet used to the full extent to help meet the gaps that families around the country are facing, that's in turn affecting women's participation in the workforce. So policy recommendations that have been proposed in this area include making high-quality pre-kindergarten available to all four-year-olds. We've seen New York State, for example, pass this, and other states have ensured universal pre-kindergarten. It's expanding access to nutritious meals and snacks to children and families that supplements the attention, the support given here. In six states, Colorado, Idaho, Illinois, North Carolina, Rhode Island, and South Carolina, there's a program called Work Support Strategies that has explored packages of work supports for low-income families that have included attention to child care issues. Next area is equal pay. So here, to note that on average in the United States, women still earn 77 cents for every dollar earned by men, with women of color earning even less. So African-American women are paid 64 cents, Latino women 54 cents for every dollar paid to white non-Latino men. And again, there's been some innovative state policies to try to address this. So in Missouri, for example, an executive order was signed by the governor to promote gender pay equity in the workplace by directing both state and agencies and encouraging private sector organizations to use best practice guidelines to identify and address gender wage gaps. There's more that can be done to partner with the private sector to encourage greater attention to workplace flexibility issues, to help improve opportunities for women to stay in the workforce as they're juggling their unpaid care work. So there's one program, for example, a national initiative called Win Work Works. That's led by the Society for Human Resource Management, that's helping businesses of all sizes and types transform the way that they view and adopt effective and flexible workplaces. And When Work Works, in fact, partners with communities and states around the country to share research, employer best practices, to inspire more local employers to create more effective and flexible workplaces. And provides performance awards to recognize where there are leaders in this area. Another key gap to address is look at gender disparities in the workforce is workplace harassment. Certainly the Me Too movement has called attention to the continued issues that especially women, but also men, face in the workplace when it comes to sexual harassment. There's more and more exploration by states and cities of mechanisms that they can, policies, executive orders, that legislatures, legislation that they can pursue to help improve accountability and prevention of workplace harassment. In Missouri, the former attorney general committed to a statewide review in partnership with a local foundation to assess existing discrimination and harassment policies across state government. In Kansas, the governor issued an executive order to combat sexual harassment and discrimination in state government. So just a note there that while some may suggest that the laws and policies in place are sufficient, there's data that and analysis that's documented that, in fact, there are too many gaps in employment policies and state-level laws that leave that don't sufficiently protect workers from discrimination and harassment in the workplace. And so that's one thing, again, that states are taking on themselves to do that analysis and to look at kind of beyond enforcement of existing U.S. anti-discrimination and equal pay laws, where there may be additional gaps or additional opportunities to strengthen the policies in individual states. This is something that there's been kind of broadly looking at workplace parity and opportunities for women's economic empowerment. This is something that has been a federal priority in the last few administrations. So, in fact, in 2014, the Obama administration, the White House hosted the Summit on Working Families that brought together a whole collection of policy recommendations where you can really dig in more detail in these areas that we've talked about today, looking at ways to improve opportunities for women to strengthen the economic well-being of working families and to reduce poverty and promote growth in states. And the Trump administration is developing its own commitments on women's economic participation, both globally as well as domestically. And they will be launching these in January. So that'll be exciting to see what steps they're taking to try to address the gaps and promote greater opportunity for women to participate in the workforce. There's also lessons to be drawn internationally, and some of this we've documented in some of our reports. So just as an example, in Sweden, coming back to paid family leave, Sweden found, you know, even where states and countries institute paternity leave, it's an area where in the United States and around the world, there's still cultural barriers around it that prevent many fathers from taking paternity leave even when they're eligible for it. Some companies are doing more to, in the United States, are doing more to make sure that men do take that leave. In Sweden, they actually instituted a use-or-lose policy that there was a segment of the leave that a family received only if the father took it. And the effects that they found have been impressive, that they found that just through that policy of ensuring that fathers took paternity leave, that mothers with previously low incomes had higher salaries. They found that it had an effect on the wage gap as well, because essentially by men taking on more of a role at home through paternity leave, there was a more equal distribution of the unpaid care work moving forward, and fewer women left the workforce. And so they have found that, again, through encouraging paternity leave, that it's had a ripple effect on issues like women's unpaid care work burden and the gender pay gap. So I'm going to close there. We can share some of these resources of the interactives we've developed. I'd also point you, there's a McKinsey Global Institute study from 2014 that looked at gender parity in the United States, sorry, 2016, that looked at advancing women's equality in the United States that does have state-specific data. So you can explore in your state both what the potential economic gains are and what some of the specific barriers are in your state, and look at some of these examples that we've talked about today that have been models of what states have done to address some of those gaps and bring women into the workforce and realize the economic potential that they can provide.
Jamila, thank you very much for your insights today and your analysis. You really left no stone unturned, so we appreciate it. We will share out the links to both reports to you all, and I hope that you will look through them. And if you have questions or comments, please do send them through. You can follow Jamila on Twitter at Jamila Biggio. You can send questions to her at jbiggio@cfr.org or else to us at stateandlocal@cfr.org. We really would love your feedback, other areas that you hope we would cover, ideas for formats and things like that as we are getting this initiative off the ground. So thank you all. Thank you, Jamila, again for today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, and thanks everybody on the line.
For more event audio, subscribe on iTunes or visit us at cfr.org.